Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Later in this hour, plans for a Hands Across Lexington event to demonstrate unity, a new literary arts festival in Moorhead, radio plays from the Louisville area, and a public art mural in Whitesburg commemorating the lives lost and properties destroyed in the flood of 22. In Kentucky, federally funded Head Start and early Head Start programs have roughly 13,000 funded places, about 10,000 for preschool-aged children, nearly 3,000 for infants, toddlers, and pregnant women. The programs receive more than $205 million in annual federal funding. Well, now, the Trump administration is considering a major reduction in the federal rules governing Head Start. The Associated Press reports that more than 100 pages of performance standards could be replaced with roughly a dozen pages, leaving many decisions to state and local officials. Those standards currently address such matters as classroom staffing, health screening, services for children with disabilities, and family engagement. The broader proposal has not yet been formally published and could change. Joining us is Sharon Price, Executive Director of Community Action Council in Lexington. The council administers Head Start and other anti-poverty programs in Fayette, Bourbon, Harrison, and Nicholas counties. Price herself is also a former Head Start parent, early childhood teacher, and director of the council's child development programs. Sharon, are we right to think of Head Start not just as preschool, but as a coordinated system of education, health, and family support?
Well, absolutely. You know, here in Kentucky and across the nation, Head Start programs already know what quality looks like. This is not something that we're guessing on, Tom. The research already shows us that, you know, children that are enrolled in our Head Start programs, of course, number one is safe and healthy learning environments, but all of the developmental screenings that include vision, hearing, dental, nutrition, all of the research-based curriculums that are required, the teacher qualifications, the smaller class and group ratios, that is so important. And then a part that normally gets left out of Head Start is the strong family partnerships. You cannot educate a child in isolation of the family. The family and the child have to be moving along that continuum if the goal is to get children out of poverty, and that was one of the foundations that Head Start was built on. So, you know, children don't learn in pieces in our programs. Their lives aren't divided into education and health and nutrition and housing and all of those things. And Head Start recognizes that supporting the whole child supports the entire family, which strengthens the community in place. And so it's concerning to think about replacing, you know, those comprehensive standards with minimum licensing standards. That's not, in my opinion, what's best for children. It's lowering expectations for children.
Well, Sharon, if you could bring this down to the level of a child entering one of your classrooms, what services does that child and maybe the child's family actually receive over the course of a year?
Well, the first thing that we're going to do, Tom, when a family comes to us is we're going to assess that entire family, see what it is, what their strengths are and what their needs are, what needs to be improved. We're going to set goals for that entire family so that they can be better tomorrow than they are this very day. And the children are going to get all of these specialized services, because the first thing that we want to know is a child ready to learn? Do they have everything they need? And so that's why we do all of the developmental screenings, such as hearing and speech, you know, vision screenings, because, you know, I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, we had a child that was not able to, you know, we're looking at the assessments of the child and the child is scoring low and we can't figure out what to do. And we are working with the child and the family. And the child goes to get its vision examined, and the child is colorblind. And so that is very important, getting those early individual needs of the children taken care of immediately is going to help make sure that they are ready to learn, grow, thrive, and be successful in their classrooms, and then when they go to the schools.
Well, which of those services like that one exists because of federal Head Start standards rather than Kentucky's basic child care licensing requirements?
All of those. So what I'm going to tell you is Kentucky licensing and different state licensing, and I am not downing licensing and regulations, But Head Start was never meant to be daycare. Because we were never designed to be childcare, licensing is essential because what's in place there is to keep children safe, to make sure that children are safe. And that matters, don't get me wrong. But licensing was never intended to define what educational excellence looks like. We know what that looks like. You know, licensing asks the question, you know, what is the minimum required to keep children safe? And then Head Start comes in and Head Start asks the questions, what conditions produce lifelong improvements in children's learning, their health, their family well-being? And it is all of that that is involved. Licensing is one thing, but Head Start performance standards, requirements, and expectations, those are all different. And it's just a higher level. Head Start is the gold standard when it comes to early childhood education.
It doesn't take much imagination to see how this could be life-changing.
Oh, I am an example of it being life-changing. I was a Head Start mom. I've been a teacher in a classroom from infants all the way to school age. I have been a Head Start director. Now I'm the executive director. All of the things that I did to help change my life, now I'm in turn in a situation where I can help other people change their lives and know that there is more to life than living in poverty. But we got to have opportunities. Children and families have to have those opportunities. And dumbing down the standards doesn't do it. Lowering the bar, the lower you, everybody knows this, it doesn't take an expert to know this, but anytime you lower a bar, children will meet your expectations. So if that bar is minimal, that's what they're going to meet. If the bar is set and it's required and accountability is held through everybody working with the child, including the family, they will reach those expectations too.
There appear to be two related initiatives here. One is a proposed repeal of future requirements concerning staff wages and benefits. And the other is the broader rewrite of Head Start's performance standards.
Well, Tom, if you think about taking all of the over 100 pages of federal regulations and reducing them down to 10 or 12 pages, you're losing a whole lot of things that children need in order to be successful. And I think that the real question might be here is, what does America want for our youngest, most vulnerable children? What standard is that going to be? You know, we talked about wages. You know, some programs, high-performing programs, are going to continue to pay a living wage. We can't be an anti-poverty program and not give consideration to the teachers that are working in the classroom. You can't pay an impoverished wage and expect that you're going to get high quality teachers. Now, some programs will meet the standard. You know, when I talk to you about lowering the bar, when you set the bar, I just think programs will meet some of those lower bars. Now, we won't do that, but you can't pay someone $10 an hour to come in and do a professional job and think that they're going to stay. That is going to be an overlapping issue when it comes to high performing staff in classrooms.
The administration's argument is that federal requirements have become too prescriptive and expensive, and they claim that repealing the workforce requirements would provide local flexibility, avert more than $2 billion in future costs nationally, and reduce the risk that programs would have to eliminate enrollment slots to meet compensation mandates. So as somebody in your position responsible for operating these programs, is there merit to that argument?
The first thing that I want to say about the whole compensation is the compensation, the grants have not received, Head Start grants and programs have not received adequate increases over time in order to pay their staff an equitable wage for the work that they're doing. And what I will say is a lot of the burden that is on the staff come from unfunded mandates. And so whenever a mandate is given to you, funding should be provided to accommodate and make up for that mandate. Now, what I'll tell you is, are the Head Start performance standards perfect? No, I don't believe that anything is perfect. But I think that that's where you have this Head Start and community action. This is what we've done for generations. We don't just prepare children for school. We help families build futures. But there is a lot of administrative burden that does go along with it, because we need to know everything that we can know about that child while that child is in our program, so that child is prepared when they go to school. The developmental screenings, everything that we do requires paperwork. But there are a lot of things that can be done at the federal level that would reduce some of this administrative burden.
Head Start's importance is especially pronounced in eastern Kentucky, in our coverage area, and also parts of south central and western Kentucky, where poverty rates are higher and private child care options are fewer and hard to get to. A rural county might have fewer enrolled children than, say, Louisville, but a much larger share of its low-income preschool population dependent on Head Start. Sharon, the reported broader proposal could shift decisions about staff-to-child ratios, screenings, curriculum, and other requirements towards state and local law. What might families notice if those federal protections go away?
Well, it's hard to think about higher staff-child ratios, right? And Head Start's staff-to-child ratio and group ratio sizes are even lower than that of the Kentucky state regulations for licensed daycare providers. When it comes to that part of it, when you think about it, if you have to follow the state ratios, then we would be following the state ratios in Kentucky. That one wouldn't be a big deal for us because we are not going to increase our ratios. Because I don't know about you, but I have children, and it's hard enough at home when you have one or two kids trying to keep it all together to ask a staff person to have more children. But when you think about different states outside of Kentucky who have larger ratios, and some states are petitioning and working toward increasing those ratios to something like one teacher to every 18 children, quality Head Start programs should look the same. The expectations should be the same regardless of what state you live in. And I think that that is going to be the demise of Head Start, because that is not what Head Start was founded on, in my opinion.
The draft proposal that we've seen has also raised concerns about additional documentation for families who are homeless or unemployed, and possibly new restrictions affecting immigrant families. What happens when families are worried that enrolling a child could expose them to scrutiny or immigration enforcement?
You know what, Tom? That's very tough. And I don't think that that is a role that Head Start programs or child care programs should be playing as far as, you know, in the immigration game. I think that Head Start programs should be focused on the family that comes through the door enrolling that child, because if they live in this community, everything that happens with them affects everything that happens in this community. And we're in two places, because we're saying we want to reduce administrative burden, but now we're going to give you some more unfunded mandates, you know, to go along with your program, with now you have to verify all of these things. I think that when children come through the door, those are children coming through the door, and we need to meet them where they are in order to be able to help that family and make sure that everybody in our community is safe. Because the dollar tag on this, people worry about how much money is going to early childhood education. And I'm going to tell you that that is not the biggest thing that I think that we need to be worrying about, because quality is not expensive. Poor quality is. And standards that we have are not barriers. Those are promises that we make to the children that are in our community. And if we are willing to lower the standards and the expectations of the children that are living in our community, what message is that sending about what they deserve? I will always stand up for children and families in our community. You know, I've spent more than 30 years watching what happens when children believe in them before they even believe in themselves, when people believe in families, when families come to you with absolutely nothing and they get hope and people being successful. I'm in a position where I've been doing this long enough to see that children that went through Head Start programs are now attorneys and doctors and business owners and, you know, public speakers and all of that. And all of that did not happen by accident. It happened because Head Start set the bar high, not just for children, not just for families, but for all of us. And the answer is not to lower the bar. If there's something that needs tweaking, because everything needs a review every once in a while to see what's working and what's not working, I say we change what's not working, but we keep what's working. And we keep building on it with continuous improvement. And that's the answers for me. And when I think about it for me, would I accept lowering expectations for my own grandchildren? And if the answer is no for that, then why would we accept them for children just because they live in poverty or the conditions that they were born in?
All right, that's Sharon Price, Executive Director of Community Action Council. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
At a time when our communities feel fragmented, a group of people in Central Kentucky is proposing a simple but ambitious response, Standing Together. The event is called Hands Across / Stand Together, Linking Arms, Lifting Hope, and it's happening on Friday, August 28th. And here to tell us all about it are Stu Johnson and Jeff Rubin. Stu, it's really good to have you here as a guest. Before his recent retirement, you might know, listeners, Stu was a reporter for WEKU. He was with us for many decades. Jeff Rubin from Berea is an advocate against age discrimination. He's served as a member of the Kentucky Institute on Aging. He hosts a podcast on contemporary community issues and is a contributing columnist to print and online media. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
So, as I understand it, the plan for Friday, August 28th, is for people in Lexington to gather for 1 hour along a route stretching from Versailles Road through downtown and onto Winchester Road. So, let's begin with that image, people standing hand in hand across Lexington. Where did that idea come from, and what did you feel was happening in the community that called for a gesture like this? Jeff?
Like many people, I am angered and upset by the current climate in this country. And I've been to a number of rallies, and I've seen what appears to be division and in-your-face attitudes of one side for the other. And I just believe when we stop and look at things that we have more in common than we do differences. And if it comes right down to it, the idea is not what you're against. What we want to do is focus on what you're for. And you may remember that this is not a new concept, but the idea of bringing it here to Lexington is. Back in 1986, there was a Hands Across America event.
Mm-hmm. Remember that.
That event was held to address hunger and homelessness and dealt a lot with what was happening in Africa at the time. Well, they had 6.5 million people join hands from one end of the country to the other. Now, obviously, you're going to have gaps along the way. But the reality was that people stood together to make a statement. And when you look at visual statements, there are a number of ways you can make them. And this one is one of unity, one of decency and respect.
Well, Stu, this isn't a march or a rally in the traditional sense. So we think people will stand along a route and at 12:15 and then again at 12:45, they'll join hands with those around them. And so I'm wondering, why did you choose stillness and physical connection rather than speeches and chanting and marching?
Tom, I think the answer there is all about expression and the visual of unity, of true unity. When you're holding hands along a busy stretch like Versailles Road, off down Main Street, out Midland, going out Winchester Road, that visual of just holding hands there and gathering together, I think it does make a statement. One of the things that we really, from the get-go, have stressed, it's a nonpartisan event. It's not about politics. It's trying our best to bring people together beyond politics. I was a reporter for Frankfurt. I think 86 was the first session. I saw a lot of politics in Frankfurt when the Democrats were in control and when the Republicans were in control. And that always was a concern to me because of the way things could really diminish into a lot of negativity, right? Mm-hmm. So this is all about trying to get beyond that and say we can accept and can understand each other better.
You know, to kind of bring this down to brass tacks, would you agree with me that many of us are just sick and tired of partisan politics? I mean, done with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have to tell you, as I said earlier, I attended a number of different rallies. This was quite different. I think people were hungry for something uplifting, something positive. And there's a big difference in how you approach an issue when you approach it from the standpoint of saying what you're against as opposed to what you're for. And I never saw this as whether it be red or blue, because the issues that matter to us cross any line. We're all concerned about having enough to eat. We're all concerned about grocery prices, gas prices, affordable housing, public transit, the ability to live with decency and respect neighbor to neighbor. And, you know, enough finger pointing. That's what this country has become. And yet I'm reminded of a statement that has been voiced by a number of leaders throughout the years. And so the nation is judged by how it treats its least, its last, its oldest. My question is, how are we doing? And what can we do better? And I think when we begin to see that we have more in common to do difference, you lower the temperature and you begin to say, wait a minute, I might not agree with you, but yeah, I want my children to go to school in safety and not have to be concerned. I want a decent job, and I want others to feel that they can have the same right as I do.
You're looking for about 10,000 people to line the route, and that's a pretty ambitious goal. Is filling every foot of the route essential to the success of the event?
No. Last year, we started out with an idea and four people, and we said, well, we don't know how it's going to turn out, but we struck a chord with a number of faith-based organizations and nonprofits, et cetera. And at the day of the event, we had 800 people we could count that lined the route. So we did not fill all six miles. But the people who came out from a variety of places. We had a nursing home residents come out and contribute. We had people from a homeless bus in Berea come up and contribute. We had office workers who came out and contributed. So the opportunity to express ourselves was very significant, plus the fact that during that time that we were there, we were able to determine that 15,000 vehicles passed by us, and many honked their horns. And every major media outlet in Lexington covered the event. So do you want to say it was successful? In many ways, it was. And we have proof of concept based upon the visual reality of what happened. And there are people who said, I would love to have been there last year, but I'll make it a point to be there this year.
Well, you've made the point that this is not about politics, but about people, a positive, nonpartisan affirmation of the entire community. What does unity mean in this context? Does it mean agreement, or can people stand together even while they hold very different beliefs about what the community needs?
Absolutely. What happened to the time when we were able to disagree civilly and were able to listen to the other person's point of view and come to what was called compromise? You don't get everything you want, I don't get everything I want, but at least we can come to an agreement that something needs to change and change for the better. But that opportunity has been lost in the rhetoric of our times, and it's time to bring that back.
Stu, I see you have something to add.
Yeah, I wanted to say, Tom, that we live in a society, and we might as well call it as it is, that there are people that may have a very liberal look at life or a very conservative look at life. I think it's very important personally to, you may not agree with the real conservative or the liberal, but to at least respect them and listen and say, hey, I can try to understand you on this, maybe that issue, maybe this issue I can't, this one I can. I think it's just getting beyond that. And I also want to say that I talked about my years in Frankfurt and seeing sometimes the pettiness of politics come through. But I always came away with people would ask me, you know, about and about, say, what about, oh, you're over there in Frankfurt with that mess. And I'd say, you know, if you talk to the lawmakers, Republican, Democrat, about anything outside of the politics, there's lots of good people there. It's when the political hack goes on that sometimes it can go downhill.
Boy, that's a good point. This gathering is being held on August 28th, and that's the 63rd anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington. How does that history inform this event, and how do you honor the moral seriousness of that anniversary?
Oh, I think Martin Luther King's whole legacy speaks to the humanity of people and our ability to truly bring out the best in one another. This year, I know that Reverend Sharpton is advocating for a march on Washington for voter rights. Well, certainly Martin Luther King spoke of voter rights, but he spoke of so much more. And, you know, I believe that many of us grew up at a time where decency and respect was expected and not something that was shunted aside because it's, I can say whatever I want to whoever I want. No, when you see people face to face and you look one other in the eye and you're saying, wait a minute, look what they're for and look what I'm for. Maybe we're not that different.
Well, large public events like this do raise some practical considerations: traffic, pedestrian safety, accessibility, weather, coordination with businesses and residents. What preparations are underway to make sure that the event is safe and respectful of the neighborhoods that it passes through?
Well, I'll let Stu handle that.
Okay. Well, come to find out, Tom, that as far as asking the mayor's office, and this was the case last year, the big no-go was don't block any intersections, which makes perfect sense. But outside of that, gathering on the sidewalks, different places, if you're not going to block an intersection or cause, you know, any kind of traffic impairment, then, you know, it's, everything's good to go. So that really has not been an issue, wasn't an issue last year, and we certainly don't we plan for it to be an issue this year.
Well, there might be people listening to us right now who are sympathetic to the idea, but skeptical of symbolic events. They might ask, what changes after everybody lets go of one another's hands and goes home? What would you say to them?
I would say exactly what you were saying earlier, Tom, that people are fed up with the status quo. That if I can see my neighbor holding hands with someone else, you're beginning to lower the rhetoric. You're beginning to see that, wait a minute, we're all of the same blood. And how does that message carry over for you? Are we planning other things? I'll say is we one of our colleagues put together a toolkit for how you can do the same type of event in any community. And so we're hoping that other communities take this on. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could join arms throughout Kentucky? How unrealistic is that? If we could do it here, we could do it anywhere.
I guess there's a chance that people standing next to one another that discover they're from different points on the political spectrum might wind up going to have a cup of coffee.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
For somebody listening who wants to be part of this, what should they do now? What kinds of volunteers or community partners do you need?
We are reaching out to any organization, faith-based. Last year, we had the Catholic Diocese of Lexington involved. We had the Episcopalian Diocese of Lexington involved. We had NAACP, the Human Rights Commission. We reached out to people who were working with the homeless, et cetera, et cetera. We had Rabbi Warshafter from Temple Adith Israel and the Jewish Federation out there. We had someone from the Christian-Muslim Dialogue Group there. So the diversity was there. And that was a message that comes across very clearly. It's only an hour, and we're asking people to give of an hour to express themselves.
All right, Stu Johnson, Jeff Rubin, thank you so much for stopping by Eastern Standard, and good luck on the 28th.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. If you just joined us, earlier in the hour, we heard local reaction to a reported White House proposal to deregulate the Head Start program, and about a unity event planned for August 28th in Lexington that organizers hope will bring out enough people holding hands to form a human chain stretching from Versailles Road all the way out Winchester Road. Writers, readers, artists, and publishers will be in downtown Moorhead August 28th through the 30th for the Appalachian Literary Arts Festival. Hosted by Coffee Tree Books in collaboration with the Rowan County Arts Center, the festival will feature authors, readings, writing workshops, panel discussions, music, and all kinds of activities throughout the Moorhead community. The aim is to celebrate the creative life of Appalachia, amplify the region's diverse voices, and encourage a new generation of storytellers. Andrew Preston is president of the Appalachian Literary Arts Festival. He joins us from Moorhead right now. Andrew, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having me.
And so let's begin with the festival's central idea. What prompted you and your fellow organizers to create an Appalachian Literary Arts Festival? What did you feel was missing that this gathering might provide?
Well, I think it's not so much what was missing from Moorhead, but what was already there that we wanted to really bask in. So Amy Leanne Richardson and I are both writers, and we are frequent visitors to Hindman Settlement School and the Appalachian Writers Workshop. And I just really love the writing community and the music communities, and I've been a part of them for a long time, and I thought, there's so much of this happening in Moorhead. There are so many talented writers. The proximity of Rowan County to both far eastern Kentucky and Lexington, it's sort of the central hub between them. And so Amy and I were chatting, and we thought, you know, this is the perfect spot to do something similar, to bring a writing community celebration here. And so that's sort of what started it.
The word Appalachian can bring on strong senses of place and identity, but it could also carry those stereotypes that are imposed from outside the region. What picture of Appalachia and of Appalachian literature do you hope the festival presents?
Yeah, I think there's such an incredible variety of genre and style of writing and music in our area. I think that people who aren't from here do have sort of this image of mountain music, and certainly that history is rich and should be celebrated, but there's also contemporary versions of that that exist now. And so I think just looking through the applications when we had all of the authors submitting their works, every single title was so wildly different in style and genre. So our committee selected around 45 authors for this year's festival, and we've got things ranging from horror to literary fiction to romance to sci-fi to nonfiction, creative nonfiction, poetry. There is so much variety. And I think what you said earlier, you're right, that it's all sort of rooted in place. But that can look so different and have so much. Appalachia is a really big place. So I think it's going to be really exciting to see all facets of that represented at the festival.
Well, give us a sense of the weekend itself. What will we find when we arrive at Moorhead?
Yeah, so Friday is sort of our smaller day. It's our introductory day. We've got a lot of family and youth activities happening on Friday. So the Rowan County Public Library will be doing a youth story time event, as well as a scavenger hunt. And that's sort of welcoming in the families who are just getting settled into town. And then that evening, Amy Leanne Richardson's Bloodroot Writing Collective will be doing an open mic and a reading with the community to sort of wind down and welcome everyone in. Saturday is when everything really big starts to happen. We've got writing workshops and classes happening at the Rowan County Arts Center all day that day from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Four different classes from four different Appalachian writers who are current in the industry. So you can sign up for those classes online at our website. And that's actually the only ticketed event. Everything else, the whole weekend is totally free. So then after that, we've got a concert featuring Will Oldham as our headliner. He's a fabulous songwriter. And all four of the musicians who are performing in that big concert are also authors. And so their books will be for sale right outside of Sawstone Brewing on the lawn with a special outdoor pop-up shop from Coffee Tree Books. And then Sunday is our main author day. We'll have 45 to 50 authors inside Coffee Tree Books, signing their books, selling them, chatting with folks. We'll have food trucks. We'll have additional music and readings outside. We've got a publisher lawn where publishers ranging from Penguin Random House all the way to some of our small local presses will be present, talking about what's coming out from their presses and their publishers, networking with authors. We'll have a vendor lawn, and all of the vendors were handpicked to include specifically bookish things. So you can find bookmarks and bookish apparel and art prints and things like that based on Appalachian literature. And then everything downtown in Moorhead, all of the local businesses have teamed up to do something bookish. So, for instance, Back Alley Tattoos is doing literary flash tattoos. We'll have special menu items at Holbrook Drug. They have a wonderful ice cream sundaes and milkshakes, so they'll have some special items. Fat Patties downtown is doing special discounts for authors. Titans Chaos Games is going to be doing Dungeons & Dragons sort of merchandise with their trading cards. So there's too much to even mention in a small amount of time, but you can see all of the events for the whole weekend on the website as well.
Moorhead already has a distinctive cultural identity. It's a university town, of course. It's a gateway to Eastern Kentucky. It's a community with deep connections to visual art, music, and storytelling. So what does hosting this festival say about Moorhead and the role it can play in the cultural life of Appalachia?
Yeah, since I've been in Moorhead, I came here as a student in 2011. I went to the university and graduated in 2015. And I was just overwhelmed with the arts in the community. And it's just been the kind of place where no matter what art form you're doing or what kind of art community you're engaging with, there's something in Moorhead for it. You know, I'm a songwriter. I've performed in Moorhead. And I've done workshops, songwriting workshops and things like that. And that was sort of my introduction into the art world of Moorhead. And then it's also interconnected. So I met videographers, I met authors, I met visual artists, I met culinary artists. I mean, it's just such an interconnected community. And I think that this sort of event is just a highlight of that and like a giant networking opportunity, and also just a place for people who love to consume art and read books and listen to music. And, you know, I think there's something for everybody here.
Well, you really detailed this a moment ago, festivals as creators of economic activity, but they can also change how people see their own town. What lasting effect do you hope that this weekend might have on the people of Moorhead and how they view their town?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we often Moorhead gets this reputation of, you know, it is a university town. And so there's sort of this dichotomy of the townies and then the students. And I've been both. And it's kind of funny once you've been both to see how different it can feel. But also having been both, there is so much crossover. There really isn't a distinction. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be really fantastic to, you know, shine a light on everything that makes the town unified. And that is our sense of art and place, and you know, Coffee Tree Books is sort of a hub of that in town. It's cool as a community space to see all these different people are coming in and reading and buying coffee and hanging out. And we have all sorts of businesses like that in town. So I hope that, you know, this festival can be sort of a reflection of that and kind of unify everybody.
The Appalachian Literary Arts Festival is happening August 28th through the 30th in downtown Moorhead, with events centered at the Coffee Tree Bookstore and the Round County Arts Center. Andrew Preston is president of the festival. Andrew, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Reggie Van Stockham has joined us from time to time here on Eastern Standard, sharing his observations from treks to far-flung places all across the Commonwealth. And now Reggie is back with a set of radio plays produced by our own Neil Kesterson. Eastern Standard's technical director and sound designer, and at one point in this series, Neil even comes around from the control room and into the studio to join the fun. Reggie Van Stockham, tell us about these radio plays. How'd you have the idea?
The idea comes from the old Lux Radio Theater in the 30s. I'm involved in the theater. Jack Wan, my playwright's involved in the theater. It's just exciting to be in theater and to work with playwrights and to hone your skill as a speaker. So I was listening to those old plays, and I don't want to say that they're stodgy, but they're not in a modern format. And yet, if you get online, you can hear podcasts that are essentially plays, but in a more modern style. And what that means is that there's special effects, that there's trending music, that there are narrators that are compelling in a certain way. And rather than having a play read from the beginning to the end, you have a narrator bring on the setting and go into short scenes where your actors read the lines written by a playwright. And it takes a little extra understanding of that format to get the good stuff out in your writing. And fortunately, I work with Dr. Jack Wan, and he's brilliant at that.
Now, you've written these stories, correct?
Correct. With Dr. Wan, who is the principal playwright.
And he's adapted them.
Yes, and he's adapted the first three he adapted from my books.
Okay, and Dr. Wan, by the way, has spent his entire life in theater in both the academic and the professional worlds. He was even inducted into the Creative and Performing Arts Hall of Fame and has a theater named for him. So tell us about your collaboration with Dr. Wan.
Well, it's one of those fortunate things that happen in your creative life to come across someone who has a level of brilliance that can be backed up by experience. Jack was coming off of 10 years teaching Shakespeare in the American Academy in New York City. His daughter had moved to Eminence, Kentucky, and he came back to be with her. We have a theater in Shelby County, the Shelby County Community Theater. He is a vigorous playwright, teacher, and actor. He wanted a place to apply his trade, and I guess it was 2010 now that he came to one of our play announcements, and oddly enough, it came over to me out of the blue and said, I understand you write music. And unabashedly, I said, well, of course. And he said, do you think you can write music to Shakespeare? And I wasn't even lying, but I came close by saying, of course I can do that. And it wasn't 6 months later, I'd put music to Shakespeare's Cymbeline, and we were over at Asbury College to one of the premieres of his work called Shakespeareans. And he and I have been acting. I've been studying in his classes. We have been writing plays together ever since.
Are these plays about any particular thing? Is there a theme?
The first things we wrote were musicals. And we've had two musicals that we've actually premiered on stages in the Louisville area. One was about country music wannabes called Jubilee Barn Dance. Another was based on one of my short stories called Tower by the Thames, a very creative a musical set, a comedy set in London, England. And since then, we've written three one-act plays based upon my books. My books tend to be either fiction science or cosmic horror. And recently, we've gotten into these radio theater dramas. The first three that we did were based upon my fiction science cosmic horror books. The first one was Cosmos the Stellar Stalker. The second one was Sidestep. Really cool settings for both of those. The third one, which we're just wrapping up post-production now on, is Return to Mars. That's the one that, that Neil is in. But we've entered into a new phase where we're taking old works of Jules Verne, and we're bringing those into the radio drama setting, five episodes, about an hour and a half, in the format that we kind of perfected in our first three.
I have to ask, is there a difference between science fiction and fiction science?
There is. And you might catch that from the interest that I have in Jules Verne. Jules Verne's often called the father of science fiction, but he really isn't, and he wouldn't claim that if he was here to answer the question. he was very knowledgeable about scientific developments, and what he would project as possible future developments were already in the works and were very feasible, and in fact, tended to occur after he wrote about them. In my writing, because I'm a biologist also, I write about a lot of real science in my fictional work. Now, my fictional work can be pretty wild out there, Cosmos the Stellar Stalker, but the setting is always based on good, solid biology. My son has a doctorate in physics, so I always run it through him. It's good, solid physics. The storyline is the fictional part.
What do you have to keep in mind when you're scripting a play for radio as opposed to something that people can actually come and see?
You've got to recognize that it is good writing that makes good acting, that makes good plays. And fortunately, I work with Dr. Jack Wan, who is an excellent playwright. He's directed more than 350 plays, brought theater departments online in two prominent universities. He understands the elements of these. You say in a play what has to be said, because nothing else could be said by a character but what you write. And if you do that, it's very tight, it's very emotive, and it moves the action properly forward at the right pace. That's how Jack writes. Now, what I can bring to that is the packaging the emotional impact of the story. Okay, Jack, here's where we're going. Here are some of the elements that we have to work with. Now, can we tell a story within a certain number of scenes and allow the narrator to move from one scene to the next? But it's the writing that counts.
Okay, let's listen to a sampling from Cosmos the Radio Play.
Hey, boss, we've broken through the old rail yard steam tunnels. Pretty much as you thought. The large junction room is right where you said it would be. We've been setting everything up in there.
Is there enough room for the plates, the tube cannon, and the metal rings?
No problem. The plates are already in place.
Rummy!
That's a sampling from the radio play Cosmos from Reginald Van Stockham. He's here in the studio with me. And I mentioned that you bring our Neil Kesterson into the mix. Tell us about how Neil got coaxed over the glass here into the studio.
Well, it was coaxing, I'll tell you that. He is a real professional. As far as to getting him involved, we had a role where we had a character which was a spaceship itself. And I was thinking how wonderful if Neil, who is somewhat reserved, would be the voice of that spaceship. And that spaceship's voice would itself have an arc of character, would grow within the piece. So I had a delightful time working with him.
Well, so do we. And we've been working with Neil for 8 years now on Eastern Standard. So how can listeners find these plays online? Where do they go?
Well, you can find them in two digital platforms. They're free. You don't have to sign up. You don't have to do anything but click on a button. We have a site called wanvanstockham.com. That's W-A-N-N, my last name, V-A-N-S-T-O-C-K-U-M.com. You get to those, all 10 of our plays there. You hit a button, you hit a second button, and you can listen all you want.
All right, that's Reginald Van Stockham, and good luck with these plays. Thanks for joining us. We're looking forward to listening to them.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Thanks for inviting me back.
Cosmos, Cosmos, Cosmos and the Void. Cosmos.
Now to Whitesburg, where memories of the flood of 2022 still run deep. Letchkonny was one of the hardest hit in the area, with loss of lives and widespread damage. To commemorate the flood, some of the people of Whitesburg are creating a public mosaic, and that in turn has been creating opportunities for storytelling, memory keeping, and even healing. Teresa Collins has the story from Whitesburg.
In front of a concrete retaining wall, amidst piles of broken pottery and glass, Lacey Hale sifts through a plastic bag full of jewelry.
A woman donated this. It was, a box full of buttons and pendants and little gems and stones and doodads of all sorts.
Hale selects several pieces from the bag. She holds each one up to a turtle-shaped outline that's been painted on the wall. She's deciding which jewelry parts will work to make the turtle and this mosaic come to life.
It's like putting a puzzle together all the time.
Hale's an artist from Whitesburg. She's spearheading the creation of this public mosaic that's behind the old post office downtown. The mosaic is sponsored by the Cowan Community Action Group in Letcher County. It's part of their annual Growing Home event, which honors the anniversary of the flood of 2022.
They wanted it to commemorate the flood, but also honor the people here, the grit, the strength.
The mosaic is also a celebration of Eastern Kentucky streams, along with the flora and fauna that call them home.
So there's Joe Pye Weed and Black-Eyed Susans and Morels, and then there's a kingfisher, a heron, there's frogs.
As part of the project, Hale asked community members to donate items to add to the mosaic. People have donated old jewelry, broken pottery that belonged to loved ones, and river glass found after flooding. Not only have people shared physical items, they've shared their stories too.
It's been a way for me too to learn about people in the community that I might not have been able to meet before.
One person Hale's connected with through the project is Lee Burke. Burke lives in McRoberts alongside a creek. The night of the flood, Burke heard his mom call out.
She said, "Lee, you better check that creek." And I said, "It's a creek, it ain't going nowhere."
Eventually, Burke did get up to check.
And when I looked out that window, it was already a raging river.
As Burke stood with his mom at the back door, he saw his dad's outbuilding float down the rushing creek. The physical building wasn't the only thing carried away. The structure housed Burke's father's treasure collections, including R.C. Coleman memorabilia that was salvaged from the local bottling plant.
It had the 100 crates in it and all the pop bottles. He passed away in 2012, and I just kept it all.
Burke watched as all those keepsakes were swept downriver with the building. In the days after the floodwaters had subsided, Burke and his brother were driving to the next town over. Something in a debris pile caught Burke's eye.
So we got out, we went across the creek, we dug through all that stuff, and sure enough, it was a red RC crate, and it was still intact.
Friends and neighbors started finding crates too, and they returned them to Burke. But of the more than 2,000 bottles in his dad's building, Burke only recovered two. One was fully intact. The other was broken in half, but still had the RC logo. When he heard about the mosaic, he decided to donate the broken bottle to Hale.
It makes me kind of want to cry now. I mean, it was just so touching that a piece from his father, who would trust us to use and break and put in this big wall. My intern, Julian, was like, "We should put it in the blue heron's neck." And so that's what we did.
Burke also donated a mug of his mother's, who passed away in 2024. For him, having his parents' objects in this public artwork is a way of honoring their lives.
They're both gone, and I'm just like, it's just a little bit of keeping them alive.
Mosaic is like an archive of the community, says Hale. It's a reflection of what they found important and beautiful.
This story was a collaboration between Mimi Pickering of Apple Shop and Teresa Collins of the Center for Rural Strategies, produced and edited by Nicole Musgrave. It originally aired on the Rural Remix podcast feed. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of our interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.